Rachel James lost her sight due to diabetic retinopathy, but it wasn't the only battle that she had to contend with at the time. Joining us now to tell us her incredible story is Rachel herself. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio today. Now, you started to lose your sight in your early 30s due to diabetic retinopathy, didn't you?
That's right, yeah. Started to go downhill quite slowly to begin with, and then it tended to get worse. And one thing sort of led to another. I ended up having vitrectomy and retinal peel, and then that led to cataracts, and that led to acute angle glaucoma, and I also got corneal ulcerations and posterior capsular pacification, and pretty much everything that could have gone wrong went wrong one after another.
Yes, a lot of things have happened regarding your eyes over the years, Rachel, and you're at that kind of age where, you know, you were making huge strides in your career. You have worked in radio previously, haven't you?
I have, yeah. Most of my life I worked in radio and in the music industry and media, you know, all kinds of things. So I've always had that sort of connection, really.
So what is it like in Guernsey then for blind or partially sighted people? Because, you know, you're talking about this fabulous career that you had, and, you know, you underplay it slightly because you were so well known in Guernsey for your media work. And, you know, you played a lot of clubs, you DJed, you had the most amazing career going. Did that all just come to a sudden standstill when you lost your sight?
Sort of, for other reasons, which I'm sure we'll discuss in a minute. I'd sort of taken a bit of a backseat anyway, so I'd kind of quietened down on perhaps the public appearance front, but I was still doing an awful lot of work behind the scenes. So at that time, I was remixing for people like DMC. So I was remixing artists like Jessie J, Black Eyed Peas, Michael Jackson. And I was signed to Sony Music for a while as well, a few years before that. So I'd done a lot of behind the scenes work where perhaps people might have known my music, but didn't necessarily know who I was if they saw me in the street, which is sort of the way I liked it, really. I never wanted to be recognised. I just wanted to be acknowledged by my peers, I suppose.
Well, you know, you do have a phenomenal story. And as you said, we will go on to the next part of your story very shortly. But in terms of you know, being in Guernsey and having suffered, you know, the way you have with your sight, how did you manage to cope? I mean, what are the facilities like there? What are the organisations like there? Did you get much support?
It's a difficult one because there's really only one hub of support here, and that's the Guernsey Blind Association. And there's only two people who work there. It's a very small operation. They do their absolute best, but they've got an awful lot of people to support. So, you know, initially, I probably could have done with a little bit more support from mental health services. I didn't feel I got quite the support I could have done with because obviously I was going through something of a grieving process and a great deal of depression at the time, as I'm sure, you know, anyone who's lost their sight will understand. But what I can't deny is that the Guernsey Blind Association were, you know, they did everything they could for me, and they've given me a lot of, you know, tools and things that have helped me to continue living as normal life as possible. If I've needed anything, I've just called them, asked them, and they've said, yeah, no problem, we'll sort that out, as long as it's within reason. I'm sure if I ask them for a driverless car or something like that, they might question it, you know. Although I'm looking forward to days coming in, because then at least we'll all be able to go anywhere without having to have a driving license.
I know, wouldn't that be brilliant? I've actually, yeah. You know, I did pass my driving test first time round when I was 17.
So did and I, it's, yeah.
It's the one thing I miss most about not being able to see. I know that sounds crazy. You know, it is the one thing I really do miss, being able to jump in a car and just go anywhere. You know, you were going through such a horrendous time, and I know what it's like to lose your sight. Obviously, I'm completely blind, and I also lost my sight due to diabetes when I was 19 years old. So I think when you are kind of young and on the threshold of your life and your career and everything that you're getting up to, and you see your friends all getting on with their lives, all about you, and suddenly you're kind of thrust into this world of darkness, it's terribly, terribly difficult. But you didn't just have sight loss to cope with as well, because from a very, very young age, you also struggled with your sexuality, didn't you? Your gender, in fact.
My gender identity, yes. I was born a boy, and I always knew that I was different, that there was something that wasn't quite right about me. At a young age, I didn't know really what it was because, well, there wasn't, I'd never heard of transgender when I was little. I struggled a lot, and as I grew up through my teens, I felt that that was what I was, but I didn't have the guts to do anything about it or tell anyone about it. So it took me quite a long time, and I got to 30, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. So I started making headway towards making transition and getting diagnosed, which that all went smoothly. That was fine. But unfortunately, at the point just as I began my transition, was also the point where my eyesight started to decline quite considerably. So as I was going through this process, which is traumatic and difficult enough as it is, I was also losing my sight at the same time. Not really having any idea how I was going to be able to earn the money to see myself through all the surgeries I needed. So that was a pretty tough time for me, pretty dark days, but
Oh,
yeah.
it just sounds like such a horrendous situation, because it's hard enough dealing with one massive life-changing experience, never mind two at the same time. And it's one of those things that automatically I'm thinking, well, did you not ever think about maybe leaving the gender side of it until after you dealt with the sight loss part of it? Because the sight loss thing, you couldn't help, you couldn't stop, you couldn't hold back. Whereas, I just wondered if you would have been, thinking that, oh, I'll sort my eyes out and then sort my gender.
All my ophthalmologists kept saying, well, just let's get your eyes sorted first and then you can deal with that later. What a lot of people don't realize with transgender people, they think that, we choose to do this. And it's sort of like, oh, well, you've chosen to become a woman. So, you can sort of pick and choose when you're going to do it. We don't choose. It's not a choice. I grew up feeling like a girl. I knew that I was wrong on the outside. I felt uncomfortable. I felt unhappy. And at the point when I decided to transition, the reason that I decided to transition was because I got to a point where it was that or die. It's that serious. The suicide rate's very, very high. It's 10 times above what the general population suicide rate is. So it's about 41% in transgender people. And for that reason, because we struggle to cope, we can't function. And despite what was going on with my vision, I couldn't bear it anymore. I had to do something about it. Otherwise, I think if I'd had nothing, if I hadn't been working towards, that dream, I think I probably would have just given up altogether. I had to keep working towards my goals and my dreams, despite what was going on with my eyes. I just thought, no, it's okay, it puts a limitation on me, but I'm not going to let it be a barrier. It just makes what I'm going through slightly more challenging, but it doesn't need to stop me. You've got to keep going regardless. You've still got a life on the other side of your sight loss, no matter what you think.
So you were obviously, I'd imagine, excited about the prospect of going through this, gender reassignment, having the operation. I mean, that must have been nerve-wracking, but quite exciting at the same time, because you were going to become the person that you always felt you were anyway. Was that a kind of distraction almost from the sight loss?
I suppose in some ways it was. In some ways it made it harder because I felt that, am I ever going to get to see the end result? Am I ever going to really know who I am? But then there was the other part of me that was just like, does it really matter? As long as I feel right and fit anatomically correct, then that's what matters. I mean, as it happens, I've been kind of lucky because I've managed to retain a certain amount of vision in one eye. So I have been able to see the sort of end result of both my body and facial surgery. So I've come out of it with that at least. So even if I lost all my sight now, I know that I'm happy with how I look. That was something I think that was a worry for me at one point. But yeah, I had even further complications along the way, in as much as well as battling with my gender issues and my blindness. Also living in Guernsey at that point in time, there was no funding for gender reassignment surgery available, and I had no chance of funding it myself. So I was also at the same time fighting the battle on behalf of all transgender people in the islands to get gender reassignment surgery funded. And I launched a 3-year campaign, which started with me writing letters and ended with me dictating letters over Skype to my sister and her typing them, printing them off and sending them to me because I could no longer see enough to type them. I kept battling, they kept rejecting me, I kept fighting, they kept rejecting me. And in the end, they gave in, they revised their policies, and gender reassignment is now fully funded in Guernsey due to the battle I put up.
I think it's an incredible, incredible story, because a lot of people would have just thrown in the towel. But sometimes I think, you know, if you really believe in something and, you know, you really want something badly enough, then you will just fight tooth and nail to yeah. get your own way. And it's because of people like you that people in the islands now will be able to live the lives that they're supposed to live should they want to. I have yeah. to say, you know, you did mention earlier on that you lived in Guernsey and you liked being quite annoyed, even though you were kind of well known in the music industry behind the scenes, you like being anonymous. This must have brought you into the forefront of the media attention, because I know you've done a lot of media since trying to kind of raise awareness about transgender, yeah. and you've been so incredibly open and amazing about it. But what was it like in Guernsey, a small, small community? Did people turn their backs on you, or were they really, really helpful and supportive?
There's sort of two sides to that. No one really turned their back on me. I can't say anyone sort of said, oh, I don't want to know anything about that, you know, or no one sort of thought I was strange or anything. People were very supportive. But I suppose what I did find is some of my male friends, being on a small island, there was a bit of a sort of like, yeah, well, we're cool with it, but, you know, we're kind of not sure we want to be sort of seen around you too much. You know, we don't want to hang around with you because we might get tarred with that brush, which I suppose in a community of this size is understandable. I did have a little bit of that. I found some people sort of, they were okay with it, but they distanced themselves from me. But, you know, by and large, people have been fantastic. They've been really supportive. I can't say I've had any bad experiences, and hopefully that will continue to be the case. I think I was the first person as well to transition on island. I believe so, because all the people before me had transitioned, had, especially because the surgery wasn't funded, they moved over to the UK, gone and lived over there for a few years, had all the surgery, done everything they had to do, and then maybe come back afterwards. I made a decision that I wasn't going to be run out of my home, have to leave my family and my friends. I wanted to be on my own home turf and be with the people who were going to support me and care about me. So I said, no, I'm staying right here. I'm staying put, which is exactly what I did. I must say that I think my vision, losing my sight in some ways actually helps, which probably sounds a bit strange, but I used to care a lot about, you know, were people talking about me? What were people saying about me? Were people looking at me? And when I started losing my sight, I just thought, well, I can't see them, so I don't know. So why care? You know, what's the point in worrying about what might be happening? If I'm unaware of it, just forget about it. So it really kind of brought me out of my shell more, I think, because I stopped caring what people were saying or if anyone was staring at me.
Do you know, there's something to be said about that. And I know to many people who maybe don't have sight loss, it might sound a bit strange, but I totally get what you're meaning. And I think, you know, we listen to older people say, oh, I'm at that age now where I don't care what I say. I don't care who I offend. You know, I'm at that age. Yeah. But I kind of felt that way a little bit about my sight loss. You know, I don't really care. It's not that I would never want to offend anybody with anything I say, but, you know, I think you do get to a certain stage where you think, like me, don't like me, you know, patronise me, don't patronise. At the end of the day, I don't really care anymore, because I just want my life to be the way I want it to be, and I want to be happy and comfortable in my own skin. And I worried so much all through my kind of 20s about what people thought of me and what people thought I looked like. And now I think you get to a certain age where you just don't care anymore. You think, you know, as long as I'm happy with myself. But that does take a little bit of getting used to.
It does, yeah. I mean, I went through exactly the same sort of process when I started out losing my sight. I was like, oh no, well, you know, am I going to know if people are... But then I just thought, it's that old thing of, you know, what you see is what you get. This is me, deal with it. If you don't like it, too bad. I don't care anymore. It has given me a slightly more sort of devil-may-care attitude to life. So every cloud and all of that.
Oh, very much so. Now, yeah. What about your family? I mean, were they supportive when you were losing your sight and going through the gender transition?
I suppose on the sight loss front, I mean, my mum was amazing. My mum was just, she was always by my side. She was always there. She always supported me. My sister was as well. Perhaps not so much from my brothers, but I mean, they were obviously concerned. But, you know, I think my mum and my sister gave me the most support during that time. They were great. Through the transition side of things, no one was really very fazed, actually. It was, my mum just was like, okay, well, whatever makes you happy. My sister was totally cool about it. I was really scared about telling my brothers. And when I went and told them, they just went, Guernsey's a small island. We already heard.
Right.
they literally knew like 6 months before I told them. And I was so scared. I had to go and get drunk before I could tell them because I was so scared of telling them. And when I told them, it's like, yeah, whatever, we know. So it's like we were wondering how long it's going to take you to tell us.
My goodness.
So that was that.
Well, you know, you've come through so much, and finally you are the person you want to be, the person you were meant to be, and yeah. That is just absolutely wonderful. And I know that, you know, you did have a long battle in trying to, you know, convince the government to change the laws in Guernsey with regards to gender reassignment, and you got there, but you did have to crowdfund to pay for part of your surgery yourself, didn't you?
That's right. Yes. And that crowdfund continues. It's still going because I'm still retrospectively fundraising because I've still got an awful lot to pay off a credit card now. And I'm, well, not currently working. So there's an organisation over here who helped to get disabled people into work, but I'm on their waiting list. So until I've got a job, I need all the help I can get. So
what would you actually like to do now? I mean, would you like to go back into radio, music, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I've considered it. But then on the other hand, I think maybe I might keep that more as a hobby. The problem was is that my hobby became my job, but it also remained my hobby. So I could never escape music and radio. That was all I was doing. And it sort of becomes that you never switch off. In a way, I suppose I'd like to perhaps keep the music more on the hobby side of things. And the trouble with the music industry now is it's so difficult to make a good living out of it. I think I'd like to go back in. I'd like to maybe... you know, get a 9-to-5 bread and butter job. And then if the music doesn't make any money, well, what the hey, at least I'm having fun.
You've got such a remarkable outlook. You really, really do. And I have to ask you, you know, from one woman who loves makeup to another, you must get people saying to you, you know, who does your makeup? How do you get your makeup on? I get that all the time. People think my husband does my makeup, which I wouldn't let him anywhere near my face with a makeup brush. But how did you cope with things like that? You know, makeup and fashion, and who helps you with that?
Fashion-wise, my friends help me, and if I'm going to go shopping, then they come along, they know what sort of stuff I like. But as I said, you know, I still retained a little bit of sight, so I've normally got some sort of idea of what I'm looking at. Makeup-wise, my vision's not terribly sharp for following what I'm doing in the mirror, so I generally don't bother. I do it all by instinct and feel, and, you know, I was always pretty artistic with my makeup, so it's just a question of being very careful. Taking my time, doing what I think is right, and then just making sure before I go anywhere, just ask my friends or the cab driver or neighbour or whoever, is my makeup okay? And 9 times out of 10, they'll go, yeah. And I always hope that if anyone's going to say no, it'll be one of my friends, because if I ask a cab driver, he's not going to be able to fix it for me.
Exactly. Rachel, it's been fascinating talking to you today. It really has. You're an incredible woman. If anybody is going through the sight loss journey at the moment and possibly thinking of gender reassignment, what would you say to them? How would you encourage and support them?
Well, one thing I would say definitely on the visual side of things, it sounds very cliche, but try and stay positive, because a positive sort of mental attitude towards everything will make such a difference to how your body functions. If you're stressed and you're anxious, then your body will not function to the best of its ability in perhaps fighting or repairing the problems. Another thing is, don't always believe everything the doctors tell you. My doctor said to me, they said, you've got absolutely no chance of regaining any vision. And I said, rubbish. And they said, well, why do you say that? I said, because I'm going to fight it. And they said, but you can't regrow the optic nerve. I said, well, why not? They said, because it just can't regrow. And I said, well, who do you think grew it in the first place? And they went, okay, yeah, good point. I didn't really have an answer to that. And you know, although it's a generally accepted medical situation that optic nerves don't regrow, eyes are difficult to repair, etc., etc., I think anything is possible. I mean, there's been people who've been on their deathbed and they've managed to overcome it. Look at the number of people who beat, you know, cancers and things like that. So I think it's always worth fighting. It's always worth staying positive, because, you know, if nothing else, what you might manage to do is hold off or stave off any more further damage, even if you don't regain anything. I always stay positive and eat healthy and live well, live strong. But on the transgender side of things, I just say, if it's how you're feeling, get out there and do something about it. Go to your GP, get some help. There's no point fighting it, because if it's how you feel, it won't go away. No matter how hard you try, it won't go away. Don't just throw your life down the toilet because you think, oh, well, you know, I can't do that, or it's never going to happen, because that's kind of what I did. That's why I ended up with sight loss, because I abused my diabetes, because I just thought, what's the point? It doesn't matter. I don't care. I don't think much of myself anyway. And I kind of wish I'd just done something about it sooner. But that's in the past. I'm not going to let it bother me now. But for anyone who's thinking along those lines, you've got to get out there. You've got to go and deal with it. Get on with it, because it'll probably be the best move you'll ever make in your life.
Rachel James, absolutely incredible talking to you. It really is. The very best of luck with your job search. And thank you so much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you very much.